This is Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hardzinski. Last month, the University of Oklahoma invited several renowned scholars to campus for its third annual teach-in, focusing on the American Civil War. Throughout the month of April, we've been broadcasting these presentations, and you can find previous episodes on our website, kgou.org. Today, we'll hear a lecture called U.S. Grant at the Sesquicentennial, delivered by Joan Waugh. She's a historian at the University of California at Los Angeles and the author of the 2009 book, U.S. Grant, American Hero, American Myth.
What I'm going to do in my talk today is try and challenge you, change your mind, make you aware of one of the most remarkable figures in our history that has almost entirely been forgotten and was equal to Lincoln in his era, in his time, perhaps even surpassed Lincoln in popularity and fame. So what I'm going to do in this talk, it's divided into three parts. The first part, an introduction to Grant and his place in American history. The second part of my talk, Grant in American historical memory. And the third part harks back to the title, Grant at the Sesquicentennial, which means the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And I subtitle A Time of Revision, because there is really exciting work that has come out and is coming out from major historians that will provide a huge revision of the reputation of Grant, or at least I think it will. So let me start. Commanding General of the Union Army and 18th President of the United States, Ulysses S. Grant turns 192 years old April 27th. He looks pretty good, doesn't he? In this fourth year of the Civil War sesquicentennial. Grant, like George Washington and Dwight D. Eisenhower, was both a professional warrior of a defining war and a twice-elected president. It's pretty incredible when you think of linking those three. And like Washington and Eisenhower, Grant dominated his era, which in his case occurred from 1862. He joined the war effort in 1861, but 1862, he engineered the first big Union victory of the war at Fort Donelson. From that time until he retired from the presidency in 1876, he was the man. You could love him or hate him, but he was very much a huge part of the Civil War and its aftermath called Reconstruction. This is an example of the high esteem Americans held for Grant. At his death, they struck this coin. Washington, Lincoln, and Grant, father, savior, and defender. Sometimes Grant was also called the savior of the Union. One reason why 19th century people loved Grant was because of his humble background, which proved, like Abraham Lincoln's similar background, that ordinary individuals could rise to extraordinary heights. It should inspire, his story should inspire today's Americans as well. Grant was raised on the Ohio frontier. He was educated at West Point. He was a veteran of the Mexican War. He became a hard-working farmer who built his family a log cabin. He actually lived in a log cabin. He was one of those presidents. He wasn't born in a log cabin, but he lived in one, and it's still available for you to tour in St. Louis, Missouri. Grant was working as a clerk in a leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, a pretty river town, when he answered President Lincoln's call for volunteers in the first spring of the Civil War, 1861. Although you couldn't say he was famous then or that he was fortunate like some of the other principals who came to the Civil War, it had pretty much eluded him. He was a modest person. He was like many people in the United States. He declared firmly and proudly for the Union. The 39-year-old Grant did not dwell in obscurity for long, gaining fame in Tennessee and Mississippi with a string of victories that included Shiloh, Vicksburg, and Chattanooga. He did not rise to his position without controversy. I can hardly believe that would be news to you. Like any powerful person, Grant suffered attacks on his character and on the way he ran and conducted the war. He had to deal with charges of alcoholism, incompetence, and a brutal indifference to death. Those were some of his reputation that he had to deal with during his career, 1861 to 1865, and of course, after the war as well. Grant did make mistakes, but generally, he had this quality. He was able to absorb all setbacks and disappointments, and he always displayed a calmness throughout the war that stood him in good stead. He accepted the reality of any given situation and moved on to solving the next problem. Grant's rare winning record among Union generals, and anyone who's done a study of the Civil War knows how frustrated Lincoln was in the first year and a half in the war, especially with the all-important Eastern Theater generals who could not seem to do what he wanted them to do, that just win one damn battle. But his rare record secured him a champion in the White House, President Lincoln. He was promoted to Lieutenant General in March of 1864, and he took over the strategic direction of the war, achieving victories that guaranteed Lincoln's reelection and the end of the conflict. The Union's hero was praised for his generous terms of surrender that he offered Robert E. Lee at Appomattox Courthouse on April 9, 1865. And you would have to say that together, Ulysses S. Grant and President Lincoln were going to work together. They had already united their destinies, and they were going to oversee, looking at different parts, but working as the whole, just like they did the last year and a half of the war. They were going to work together to manage what they both knew was going to be a very difficult post-war period. 1 week after Appomattox, Lincoln was assassinated. If you really think about it, what a turmoil, what chaos, what shocking things happened during the war, and then once the war was secured as far as the people of the United States were concerned, their president assassinated. It was shocking to everybody. It was certainly shocking to Grant. Shortly after, Grant became the first four-star general in U.S. history, remaining as head of the army until he was nominated for president by the Republican Party in 1868. Then Grant, aided by the newly enfranchised blacks, he's the first president to be elected with the help of black votes, of black male votes, of course, and he swept to victory, aided by his famous slogan, "Let us have peace." Simple but heartfelt. This is a portrait of Grant as president without his military uniform. Well, once in office, President Grant proved to be a strong supporter of African-American civil rights, as he was during the war. He was a strong supporter of emancipation and black soldiers. He was on board. He supported Lincoln in every way he could. He proudly signed off on the 15th Amendment to the Constitution in 1870, describing the law enabling black suffrage, and here is a quote, as a measure of grander importance than any other one act of the kind from the foundation of our free government until the present day. After leaving the presidency, Grant made a triumphal tour of the world from 1877 to 1879, 2 years. He was hailed by millions across Europe, India, China, Japan, the first president to visit the world. It was really a fascinating tour. He was hailed as a military hero and the leader of an emerging and victorious democratic global power. Grant retired to New York City, and he lost his entire savings. He was not a good businessman. Let's just get that right out. He lost his entire savings in a financial scandal and was reduced to poverty, literally living hand to mouth. To earn money, he agreed to write about his wartime experiences for this very popular magazine named Century. Century magazine had come up with a really good idea in the 1880s about publishing the accounts of the battles and leaders of the Civil War from the participants. And he agreed to write about his wartime. Obviously, they wanted to get him on board first. And it was a spectacularly successful, and so were his contributions. In fact, they were so popular that he decided to write his military memoirs just as he was diagnosed with throat cancer. While dying of that cancer over the time period of 1884 and 1885, Grant completed the writing of his autobiography, which brought renewed reverence from many citizens. This two-volume personal memoirs of U.S. Grant sold 300,000 copies and became a perennial bestseller. Grant's volumes delivered a beautifully rendered narrative of the Civil War, written from the viewpoint of the man who, after Lincoln, was most closely identified with bringing about U.S. victory. Although imbued with the spirit of reconciliation between the sections, Grant's account that you can find in this book, these volumes, made clear that it was the Northern cause, union and emancipation, that would forever remain the morally superior one. The personal memoirs is considered one of the greatest autobiographies of the English language, earning classic status both as literature and history. We don't think of Grant as a great speaker because he wasn't. But he was a great writer, and that was acknowledged at the time and since. Ulysses S. Grant died on July 23rd. This is the classic picture of him on his porch at Mount McGregor, as I so helpfully put at the top. I visited the room in which he died at Mount McGregor in upstate New York, and I was allowed to go in the bedroom, and at the top of his bed on the wall is a small portrait of Abraham Lincoln, because he linked himself with Lincoln always. When he died, he was probably undeniably the most famous American at home and abroad. More than 1 million people watched his funeral procession in New York City going down Fifth Avenue there. The dedication of his massive tomb in Manhattan on the 75th anniversary, you see it there, of his birth on April 27th, 1897, drew another 1 million+. Grant's tomb is the largest in North America, and it remained New York City's most popular tourist site until 1929. Grant's beautiful memorial sculpture in Washington, D.C. was dedicated on the 100th anniversary of his birth, and it's at the foot of Capitol Hill, facing down the mall toward the Lincoln Memorial. The equestrian statue that you see before you is the second largest in the world. It took 20 years to complete, and it's spectacular, although the Capitol dwarfs it. Most people don't even know what they're looking at when they see it today. And in fact, today, tourists rarely visit historical sites devoted to Grant unless they're school children and they're forced to go. Manhattan tomb was described by one observer as, quote, the least appreciated national monument in the country. What's the deal? His memoirs are pretty much unread. His monuments are unvisited and often found in disrepair, as this one is that you're looking at. And his reputation is synonymous with brutal warfare and overwhelming corruption and incompetence in office, in the president's office. As important as Grant's legacy was to the making of modern America, as important and appreciated as his military career would continue to be in the minds of many, by the 1920s, a constant drumbeat of criticism had already diminished his reputation. Grant, the savior of his country, had been supplanted, replaced in many people's minds by Grant the butcher, Grant the drunk, and Grant the corrupt and incompetent president. How did this happen, and why was this so? I'm going now to part two of my talk, and I just want to give you an insight on how Grant is viewed in American historical memory. And I'm going to single out one particular historical memory, and I want to talk about the Lost Cause. Since the end of the Civil War, ex-Confederates were busy writing history, and why shouldn't they? They were back in the Union again. They were American citizens. Pretty soon they were restored their right and privileges. That was, if you're fighting for the Union, that's what you wanted. But they had a version of history, and it is called the Lost Cause. The Lost Cause can be simply defined. The cause of the war was not slavery, but state rights. Southern armies were never defeated, but rather overwhelmed by numbers. The Southern soldier was brave and true, echoing the perfection of the patron saint of the Lost Cause, Robert E. Lee. White Southerners thought of themselves as wronged people. They managed to transform their defeat into a proud and defiant sense of their regional specialness and unique identity. I think that's fine so far, but it was not enough to idolize Robert E. Lee. U.S. Grant's reputation and the meaning of his cause, the Union cause, preservation of the Democratic Republic, so eloquently expressed by Abraham Lincoln, and after 1863, emancipation had to be destroyed or at least cut down to size. There was a book that began this trend. It was published in 1866, started writing history right away, by a Southern journalist named Edward Pollard. It was entitled The Lost Cause. And here's what he said about Grant. Grant, Pollard contended, quote, was one of the most remarkable accidents of the war. A man without any marked ability, certainly without fortune, without genius, without influence. To Lost Cause historians, whose influence, by the way, extended and still to some extent extends well beyond Southern boundaries, Grant was the enemy because he had defeated Robert E. Lee. If they could not defeat Grant on the battlefield, at least they could tear him down in print. And that is what they set out to do. They portrayed him as stupid and possessing inferior military skills, which seems to make sense to me. If you're stupid, you're going to be inferior whatever you do. Jubal Early, an ex-Confederate general and leading Lost Cause partisan, summed up the attitude toward Grant. This is what he said in a marvelous speech that really lays out the position of Lost Cause historians. Quote, shall I compare Lee to his successful antagonists? Well compare the Great Pyramid, which rears its majestic proportions in the valley of the Nile, to a pygmy perched on Mount Atlas. We don't have to wonder who the pygmy was. I do not have time to describe in detail, you can be happy about that, all the specific charges of the pro-Southern writers and speakers who were so influential in redirecting attention from Union victory to glorifying Confederate defeat. Some were journalists, as I mentioned, others important military figures such as Early, and all repeatedly attacked Grant's military record battle by battle. Grant's generalship, they claim, was a fraud. His triumphs in the West were the result of lucky or bad Confederate leadership. Although in reality, Grant's Western victories were for the most part very low in casualties, it was Shiloh that was singled out as the harbinger of Grant's willingness to sacrifice his men. Further, Grant only prevailed in the important Eastern theater. One of the great campaigns of the war is going to have its 150th anniversary next month, Overland campaign. He only claimed victory is because the Northerners threw more men and material. The Confederates didn't have a chance. At the time, they did think they had a chance because they didn't have to win the same kind of war that the United States had to win. The explanations, you read them, they're kind of tedious, but there's a lot of numbers games. There's controversial calculations of the comparative sizes and losses of the rival army, particularly Lee and Grant, but throughout the whole war. And if some of the lost cause partisans, there's literally one Confederate soldier standing, and while there's 10 million Federals fighting them. The truth is that Grant's reputation, especially as a 20th century advance, has been tarnished ever since, as the arguments advanced by these very influential lost cause writers continued to influence the way in which Grant has been remembered. One example that I always like to use is Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was an historian and an author. He wrote A History of the English-Speaking Peoples. And he loathed Grant, and he honored Lee. He wrote of Grant's, quote-unquote, unflinching butchery, arguing, quote, more is expected of the high command than determination in thrusting men to their doom, and concluding that Grant's abilities, when compared to the incomparable Lee, must be regarded as the negation of generalship. Churchill was neither the first nor the last historian to be perversely unaware that Lee lost proportionately many more men than Grant in the Overland campaign. And in general, I think you could call Lee, if you wanted to put a name on Lee, you could call him Lee the Butcher. If you wanted to fight and die in the Civil War, you joined the Army of Northern Virginia. And the reason Grant's losses in 1864 are higher than Lee's is because the Union forces outnumbered the rebels, but Lee's losses were far greater. In the 20th century, as Churchill's comments underscore, understanding or appreciation of the Union cause steadily declined against the mythic appeal of white Southern nobility and romanticism. It seems in the late 20th, especially in the early 20th century, if we've forgotten why so many people in the United States sacrificed so much so that the Republic could remain whole. Why was it so important? Well, Grant, for me, I used him in my research and in my book as a template for the Northern people, why the people thought that was important, just as Lincoln would be as well. But somehow it's forgotten. People often fail to understand that Grant's commanding a large army and directing several large armies and coming up with a national strategy might also have been a great test. Is it not something to direct a force of nearly a million men? Grant followed Lee in 1864, but he was responsible for Sherman and Sheridan's campaigns as well, and a number of others. At least one famous World War II general agreed. In 1944, Dwight D. Eisenhower said this: Grant devised a strategy to end the war. He alone had the determination foresight and wisdom to do it. And he was talking about the same thing many people have observed. If the North had so much men and material, why did it take them so long to win the war? It's actually very complicated. In his memoirs, Grant showed again and again in their pages, most importantly, it really mattered to him what future generations would think of the Civil War and the Union cause. He was worried that they would be confused or forget about or downplay the hardships of the United States Army and the accomplishment of winning the war and preserving the Union and bringing freedom to all sections. Well, Grant became president, and the Lost Cause historians had their say about that too, about Reconstruction. He never wanted to be president. He hated everything about being a politician. The press frenzy, this is a marvelous painting that is in the National Gallery of Grant and his generals. Just gives you an idea of the kind of way that he was lionized while the war was still going on. Grant never wanted to be president. He hated everything about being a politician. As I said, the hypocrisy. He wasn't good at glad handling. He was happy in his military career. He had achieved the highest position. He had four young children, and he looked forward to a life of peacetime work with the Army. Why did he then become president? President Andrew Johnson's disastrous attack on the goals of Reconstruction drew Grant's opposition and brought about a unanimous verdict for Grant as president at the Republican Convention in Chicago in 1868. Still, he explained to his friends, or many letters, he said things like, I've been forced into this. I'm accepting the nomination, quote, unquote, in spite of myself. But he did it because he was terribly afraid that the goals of the war, union and freedom, would be lost to what he called mere trading politicians, and felt that he had to enter the White House to protect that. He was actually proud of the fact that he wasn't a practice slick politician and entered the White House without any political experience, but he did enter it with the warm support of a majority of citizens. If Grant had only served one term as president, perhaps the successes of his administration would be celebrated rather than scorned. In 1868 and 1872, there were many things happening in the country during Grant's 8 years as president, but the key issue in both elections was Reconstruction. And he achieved resounding victories in 1868 and 1872, greatly enlarging his mandate in 1872. If you just looked at his first term, it would be impressive. He would be celebrated for his support of laws upholding civil rights, for his strong support in making sure that the 15th Amendment guaranteeing the right to vote was passed, for his generous amnesty to former Confederates, for his reform program for Native Americans, for his peaceful settlement of grievances with England, culminating in the Treaty of Washington, negotiating there. Of course, he had missteps, and he had to learn the job like every president. Are we finally going to be able to admit that we have to take a mature attitude when we judge historical figures? Because it's hard to do that when it seems that whenever you're elected president, and especially in your second term, you are headed for hell, and things start falling apart. Hello, Obama? Yes. But hello, Grant. I mean, it's just, and hello, Bush. I'm not going to single anybody out, but it is on my mind. In 1872, Grant, the first person to be reelected and serve out his full second term since Andrew Jackson, did not fare well. Scandals began to engulf his administration, like the whiskey ring scandal. there's another rule. When you're president, try and negotiate your contract so there's no depression during your administration. In 1873, there was a doozy, a huge depression, and that was surely lessened the Northern public's desire to consider unpopular, hard Reconstruction policies, Reconstruction, trying to figure out how to reunite, reconstruct the country, bring back the 11 ex-Confederate states in a way that would honor both goals of the war, reunion with the white South, and setting a place at the national table for blacks. It was very hard. And one of the things that Grant did in order to protect black civil rights, their personal safety, their ability for white and black Republicans to vote, is to send troops down, troops in elections that were very violent because of the groups like the KKK and other white groups that wanted to prevent blacks and wanted to drive Republicans from the South. Sounds funny to say that today. In some, Grant's political career proved disappointing, frustrating. He was personally honest that not one of the scandals touched him personally, but it's not a good thing. And Reconstruction at the end of his term was considered a bad thing. Bitter recriminations shaped the low esteem in which his administration has been held. White Southerners and Northern Democrats gathered together and condemned Grant's attempts to ensure freedom's rewards for African Americans. And the lost cause historians and history and ideas that I described to you were carried forth in the 20th century by powerful and influential academic historians at Columbia University, at Yale University, at all the universities and colleges. They portrayed Reconstruction as a time in which its ending had to happen to defend white Southerners who were being overtaken by what they called, historians called, out-of-control black behavior in the South. And so several generations of professors who wrote the textbooks which students read in the classrooms portrayed Grant as a cold-blooded killer during the Civil War and a dictator during Reconstruction. You can see it in two notable films, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. This is the story of Reconstruction. The caricature of Grant in popular perception did not always come from pro-Southern writers fleshing out the lost cause version of the American history. Henry Adams really set the stage for this late 19th century. Henry Adams, a descendant of two presidents, a brilliant writer and historian, he took it upon himself to make Grant the symbol for a post-war America, and he had two famous quips that sort of set Grant's reputation as president and is still endlessly republished in books. He said, "A great soldier might be a baby politician," and then my favorite is, "The progress of evolution from President Washington to President Grant was alone evidence enough to upset Darwin." As I said, those pithy comments were published and republished again and again. In our own time, I should say, for the past 30 years, the negative portrait as Reconstruction has been completely revised. Historians have taught in the classroom, it's in the textbooks, hasn't gotten to the popular mind as yet, I don't think, if young people are still saying state rights is the cause of the Civil War. But if you read the books on Reconstruction, it's not a disaster. It's history with African Americans at its center, with this moment of time in which it was, as Eric Foner describes, an unfinished revolution. Grant's low presidential rankings are complemented by I think it's a little bit strange assumption that if you know anything about U.S. Grant, you know he's a drunk. Grant had a binge or two during the war, but exhaustive evidence clearly shows that he rarely imbibed and never when it counted. It's such a frustrating issue. My students, the public audiences, when I give my talks on Grant, that's all they want to know. Was he a drunk? And what does that mean? Again, all of our important figures have flaws. Winston Churchill liked to drink too. Would we denigrate his reputation as a wartime leader because of that? Would Abraham Lincoln appoint an out-of-control raging alcoholic to be at his side bringing the war to a close? I don't think so. But it's still perpetuated endlessly in culture. I could get the research that I've had to do, so you don't have to do, watch many television shows throughout the ages that always portrays Grant as a drunk. One TV show I didn't have on my horizon was this series called The Family Guy. Have you ever heard of it? I was innocently watching it with my son when all of a sudden in this episode, a bizarre reenactment of Appomattox appeared in which Grant, wielding a bottle of whiskey, shouts insult at General Lee. And after a struggle, Confederate victory is declared, at which point a member of the crowd stood up to defend the Northern general, quote, "That drunken idiot kicked your sorry asses." My son turned to me and said, "You're writing about him?" Movie makers in the late 20th and early 21st century have virtually ignored the Union hero. I, like everyone else, watched Steven Spielberg's Lincoln. I thought it was a very fine movie on many levels. But I blinked my eye, and the scene in which Grant appeared was gone. He was on as a figure for nearly 30 seconds, which is so wrong in terms of how history actually unfolded. What you see on the screen is a sculpture. It's a very famous. It was wildly, in cheap forms, it was wildly popular. It's entitled The Council of War. And it portrays Ulysses Grant, Abraham Lincoln, and Edward Stanton. What does that mean, a council of war? Well, I can tell you what it means. It means that these three men were constantly in communication with each other. They respected each other. How were they going to end this war? What terms would the final surrender take? So forth and so on. But I want to turn right now to the final part of my talk, and that is U.S. Grant at the sesquicentennial, and I want to talk about the revision that is happening even as we sit here. Writers and historians like Ronald White are writing books on Grant once he gets back to the Huntington Library. And it's something that has been happening. This literature changing Grant's reputation has been happening for a while, since the 1990s, when his reputation began to change. And one of the reasons it began to change is that out of the centennial, that's the 100th anniversary of the Civil War, came a magnificent project that the NEH funded, and it's called The Papers of U.S. Grant. Never before was there any one place. It's really a presidential library. I have all 31 volumes in my own library, all of them collected and beautifully annotated and edited by a man named John Y. Simon. Suddenly, historians had that in front of them, and they began writing books that reflected this new view of Grant. And I knew John Simon, who was the editor for many of the volumes, and we had some interesting talks, and he was very frustrated at the image of Grant of general and president. And he just railed about the fact that it was so out of date. And he would say things like, "Surely a theory of inevitable Union victory based on numbers and industrial capacity would be ridiculous to consider after Vietnam and now after Iraq and Afghanistan. Surely a portrait of a corrupt Grant administration requires adjustment after Watergate, after Whitewater, after the Wall Street and Fannie Mae scandals, after Solyndra, the IRS. It's every administration, it seems to me, has some kind of scandal that it has to deal with. And surely a few historians would take note that under Grant's administration, black political participation in biracial governments reached levels absolutely unprecedented in our history, but even in world history, and certainly was unequaled for nearly 100 years after Grant left the Oval Office. And that is what I want to talk about now. And I want to talk about the importance. So this is a beautiful painting by George Healy, and it celebrates the moment where Lincoln met with Sherman and Porter and Grant at City Point, Virginia, on Lincoln's boat, the River Queen, to talk about Reconstruction. And that the painter, George Healy, was a good friend of William Tecumseh Sherman. And so he makes William Tecumseh Sherman the focus point of the whole painting and group. Everyone's listening. Oh, what does Sherman have to say? But it apparently was a really, really great conversation about the last days of the war and what Lincoln's vision of Reconstruction was. I want to talk about the stereotype in history, and that's what I see. Grant's historical reputation has been based on a stereotype. I looked up the definition of stereotype. It's a widely held but fixed an oversimplified image or idea of a particular person or thing. And what is needed is some really, really important works and some thought that people can bring to their understanding of Grant to reverse this stereotype. And I think there is this new work that started in the 1990s. I don't want to put you to sleep by naming all the authors, but perhaps you've heard of Brooks Simpson. Perhaps you've heard of H.W. Brand. Perhaps you've heard of Joshua Bunting. All of them have published well-received books that overturn this stereotype. And I sort of want to give you my idea of what this work, which I include my own, is all about. For the revisionist scholars, Grant does not emerge suddenly as a brilliant orator or dazzling politician. Rather, they are claiming that too many historians have magnified his flaws and underestimated his strength, creating a distorted record of his military and political career. From all this, I think the first thing that we have to do in order to bring forward a more complicated, rich, and rewarding historical portrait is to stop separating the general from the president. And too often, the careers of military leaders who also have a political career, again, I bring up the name of Dwight D. Eisenhower, the 34th president, who I think has suffered from the same kind of look. He was a great general, but a stupid politician. Not as stupid as Grant, of course. But we have to look at the military and the political career as a whole cloth. We don't want to neatly divide it as if one had nothing to do with the other. We want to approach it as an integrated experience, to emphasize, to perceive, to analyze the continuities in Grant's military career with the political career. And so the new question is this: how can we assess the overall development of Grant's judgment and powers of leadership under extreme pressure during the war, and look at it, how that extreme pressure and what he emerged with the war from, all the strengths that he had as he approached the political side of his career. The collective work is suggesting that Grant does not deserve to be dismissed as a mere puppet in the hands of radical Republicans or as some kind of clueless baby idiot in a nasty political world. What got him to the top of the heap in the harsh world of war, the drive, the judgment, the perception, the timing, were similar qualities to those that went into making a good politician. And his political bent was further burnished with the events of 1865 to 1868, which I think is a sort of a forgotten period of Grant's career. And the point that I want to make is that Grant became increasingly invested after the war in the political war that was going on, the process that would cement and secure saving the Union and prevent the war from being lost in peace. After Appomattox, he was commanding general of the Army, and he directed military policy in the post-war South, making decisions and taking actions that brought him into a political crisis in opposition with the administration of Andrew Johnson. During those 3 years, President Johnson and the Republicans both curried favor from Grant because of his immense popularity and his powerful status as the Union's hero. Grant's political position was solidified, was acknowledged by his appointment by Johnson as a Secretary of War. We don't know that Grant served as Secretary of War for 5 months between August 1867 and January 1868. Holding the post of Secretary of War proved vitally important to Grant's political maturation. During this time, he enacted and guided political policies designed to secure those wartime goals. Grant was demonstrating to the country his understanding that the issues of the Civil War would continue to impact the public policy of the country for years to come. We like our history in stereotypes and often tied up into a nice, pretty bow. William Dean Howes, the novelist of the 19th century, made this wonderful remark. He said, "Americans love a tragedy with a happy ending." That is what Appomattox provided. My students feel the same way. They are exhausted after fighting the war. But actually, you have to look at the whole period to really understand. Except for Lincoln and FDR, perhaps, Grant shouldered more grave responsibilities than any other chief executive in our history, dealing with a massively complicated job of reconstructing the nation, which can be described as the final stage of the conflict between the two sections. And more of the authors, the historians, the revisionists recognize now, building on the modern scholarship of Reconstruction, that Grant operated amid intensely racist forces in both North and South that militated against the kind of reforms that he was trying to implement to assist African Americans to get that place in the table where they could be citizens and vote. But Northern white people considered the main goal of the war, certainly by the 1870s, more important than equality for Southern blacks. In fact, studying Grant's campaign against the KKK and other actions, historians now find far more commitment to African Americans than his people in the North were willing to give. He tried, but in 1874, the Democrats were returned to a majority in Congress, and there wasn't very much he could do. Throughout his presidency, Grant remained steadfast in the belief that the goals of the war should be preserved, even as the country's enthusiasm for Reconstruction in the North's image faded away. Grant's final task harked back to his first and perhaps most important achievement, to ensure a stable transition, this time in the disputed election of 1876. He succeeded and the country reconciled for good. Few, if any, professional politicians I've read in these various books could have done better, and most probably would do worse. If revisionists are resilient and determined as Grant, there might be a chance for Grant to restore his place among the most honored figures in American history. If justice as well as scholarship is served, Grant's presidential reputation, which is already rising, might even be higher. He may not make the greatest list, but he will be called, as he was, an essential president. Grant's legacy to his own generation was deep and wide. My book argues that by the time of his death, on July 23rd, 1885, at Mount McGregor, New York, U.S. Grant was an icon in the historical memory of the war shared by a whole generation of men and women. They believed that an appreciation of Grant could only come with a recognition that he was both the heroic general that saved the Union and the stalwart president who made sure that it stayed together. For them, U.S. Grant was already both an American hero and an American myth. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. We have time for one quick question. It has to be a quick one. Do I see
a hand? And the answer is no.
Right here.
Grant's beautiful and evocative memoir. One of the things that's so striking about it is early on his ruminations on the Mexican War into which he was sent. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us, in his legacy, during the time he's writing the memoir, he writes really this blisteringly anti-imperialist indictment of American policy. How does that play in his reputation before the memoir, if he's expressing those views? How does that play? And what happens, what becomes of that voice, that view of history and American policy in the Republican Party and unto our own day?
If I had to have one question, I'm so glad I got one that would take 3 hours to answer. And that's a great question. We do have Grant in his memoirs. He doesn't spend a lot of time on anything but the war. That's what people were fascinated by. But he set up his entrance into the war and the reason why the United States went to war to save the Union so beautifully. And we learn about the Mexican War, in which he thought was unjust. Many people at the time thought was unjust. It was a phony war that President Polk engineered in order to satisfy the Southern voices in his party in the 1840s who wanted to expand the slave empire. And that, of course, was the way that Republicans explained it in the 1860s, and Grant accepted that explanation. He believed it. He did think it was an unjust war. He had a very interesting relationship with Mexico from his experience in that war and travels otherwise. And yes, I would say the generals who fought in the war were not war. They were no Theodore Roosevelt, let's put it that way, at the end of the William McKinley and who didn't want to go to war with Spain. But they cautioned against going to war. They had had enough, and they did not. They actually had a policy of trying to, if territory was to be acquired, they preferred to revert to just a peaceful acquisition. And when that couldn't be done, they just didn't do it. And the great, I talked about Grant settling the Alabama claims. He made a huge plea for arbitration as a way to settle the disputes between nations. When he went on his trip to Europe, he was with the Kaiser, and the Kaiser was so proud of the German military, he begged Grant to watch this endless parade of German military might. And Grant said, I really don't feel comfortable doing that. I don't think that's the way we should go. And he probably would agree with John Kerry when John Kerry said, we're not fighting a 19th century war, we're in the 21st century. Well, I don't know if John Kerry reads the newspaper very much, but unfortunately war has been a constant feature of human life for a long time. But the men who fought the war, including Grant, didn't want to see it happen again. And I think that accounts for the passion in which he wrote. He denounced the Mexican War as imperialistic. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Roth. Thank you.
You've been listening to UCLA historian Joan Waugh delivering a lecture called Ulysses S. Grant at the Sesquicentennial. She's the author of U.S. Grant, American Hero, American Myth. She spoke at the University of Oklahoma's teach-in on the Civil War held March 10th. You can hear these remarks on our website, kgou.org. We'll hear from another Civil War scholar next Monday at 11 a.m., Our thanks to OU Interim Provost Kyle Harper and Doug Crane with Flying Colors Production Company for their assistance in obtaining these recordings. For KGOU and Oklahoma Voices, I'm Brian Hardzinski. Stay tuned next for Here and Now, along with national news headlines from NPR and local news from KGOU.